This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 7th of April 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 130th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. We're spanning art and artistry in all their multifaceted forms in today's show. We've spun the globe and stuck a few pins in it the way we know you like it. We'll speak to art historian Sophie Richard, who spent a few years tracking down Japan's finest museums and has just published her Art Lover's Guide to them.
Private collectors, instead of giving their collection to a museum like they would do here in America, they open their own museum. Why give, you know, when you can have your own name on it and just run it yourself?
We'll take a trip to Montreal to get shocked and awed by the Chapman Brothers' first show on North American soil.
It's been an epic journey, an epic install, and I hope people will get that sense of being overwhelmed by scale that is both on that sort of monumental and micro simultaneously.
We'll also take a trip to Helsinki to check out the new exhibition on Moomin's creator Tove Jansson that aims to sort the very fine artists from the world of trolls, snorks and snufkins.
I thought she'd made Finland up. I thought Finland was like Narnia. Just these incredible characters, the Moomins and the Hobgoblin and Thingamir and Barb and the Heimdall.
Plus, we'll take the pulse of female film directing around the globe, explore the undiscovered world of Neapolitan music with Sal Da Vinci, and ever wondered what the music of Sephardic Jews sounds like? Well, look and listen no further than this week's Midori House session from Los Desterrados. What's not to like? It's all here for you on Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. Ladino is a UNESCO-protected language spoken by only 250,000 people worldwide. It was the language spoken by the Sephardic Jews, who in 1492 were expelled from Spain and Portugal and was scattered throughout Turkey, the Balkans, Tunisia and Morocco, picking up music as they went. It's quintessential world music. Los Desterrados have revived this ancient language and unearthed these songs, mixing them with the rhythms of North Africa and Turkey, as well as the musical influences they grew up with in their native North London, rock and roll, jazz, folk, funk and flamenco. It's a heady brew and one which has just won them a Songlines Music Award nomination for Best Group. They dropped into Midori House wielding ouds, cajons, 12-string basses and all for a rousing session. They started with this traditional wedding song from Morocco, Giri Ate Nu.
Kiriate nu mele ane hora, kiriate nu mele ane hora, mizugote orti peara, mizugote orti peara, hatanagul hojatara, hatanagul hojatara, sukalato, ya Allah hene peshekara.
No me le ha mejorado mi dote ordenado.
שולחנות דשן מלאים ובנים חכמים ורעים וכל רואים רואים וכל רואים יאמרו ממעלה השל שרה קרייתנו מלאה נהורה קרייתנו מלאה נהורה
That was Los Desterrados with Giri Ate Nu, and as ever, there's a little bit more from that later on in the show. Next, we'll explore Museum Crazy Japan through a new book by globe-trotting art historian Sophie Richard. The Asian powerhouse with an eye on preservation, history, immaculate presentation and an eye on how the past and the future might meet is dotted with over 5,000 museums devoted to everything from swords to video games to, of course, a rich history of art brought bang up to date in some spellbinding contemporary buildings. Sophie's book, The Art Lover's Guide to Japanese Museums, is out now, and Sophie came in to talk us through it.
The book really was born out of my own need as a traveller there to find out information about what I could see. You know, when you're in the West, you don't hear much about what's happening there, but there is a fantastic scene. It's very exciting, very varied. There are myriads of museums. And as I was just visiting by myself some of those places, sometimes finding them by chance, sometimes spending hours finding information about them, I thought, I need to write about this.
Where does Japan's love of museums come from, do you think?
Well, first of all, there is a museum for everything. You know, there's a bonsai museum.
Is there a calculator museum?
I don't know. I'll look it up. I'll let you know. There are a couple of noodle museums in Yokohama. So the term is very elastic in the way it's used in Japan. So I concentrated on art museums. It's a concept that was imported from the West in the Meiji period. In the 20th century, there was really an impressive growth in numbers, particularly after the war. And everybody wanted to have its own museum. It's really characteristic of the museum scene in Japan. Private collectors, instead of giving their collection to a museum like they would do here in America, they open their own museums. Why give, you know, when you can have your own name on it and just run it yourself? And then every company has its own museums, from beverage companies to lingerie companies, computer companies. Everybody has its own museum.
I wanted to ask you about empty museums. What do you call empty museums?
Yeah.
I guess these are collections without a home, or are they a home without a collection?
No, they're homes without a collection.
Okay.
I think the whole thing started because everybody wanted to have its own museum. So you would have regions asking one famous architect to build something for them, and then, you know, having a collection was an afterthought. Oh God, we need to have something in there. It's a bit of a problem in some regions. In Tokyo, there are a number of buildings that are specifically made for that, but they do have good shows coming. So you have to check before going to make sure that it's something that interests you and that was well prepared. But, you know, there is a National Art Museum in Roppongi, which is in central Tokyo, and it's the biggest art space in the country. It's absolutely huge. They do not own one work of art. They just rotate collections that are exhibitions that are brought to them. So it's worth checking before going to make sure there is something that is interesting there. But for me, what was important in this book was to tell the story behind the scene of other museums that really have a story and a collection and a future. I was trying to go behind the scene to, you know, open the curtain and understand why this museum was there, why this person collected this type of art. I also talk about a few artist houses, which I find very, very evocative, very atmospheric. They say a lot about the period, they say a lot about the artist. So I really was trying to find the story behind its place. And these empty museums are shells. Sometimes they have great shows, but the rest of the time they're just shells.
And do museum directors and curators in Japan and artists like talking about their practice? Or do they kind of tend to want to let the spaces that they put together tell their own story?
Well, the book was entirely interviews led. I went to every single place, and actually more. I visited, I'd say, over 100 museums and selected about 60 for the book. So everywhere I went, I would have an interview with the director or some of the curators. The vast majority was really delighted to have the opportunity to talk to somebody. They feel they don't have enough Westerners going. They don't have a voice. If you happen to be able to read something about a museum in the West, it's always about the architecture. It's going to be in an architectural magazine or in a book about architecture. And you never know what's happening inside.
You never know what the collection is.
No. Or who,
yes, exactly. Yeah.
So that was a great opportunity for me to hear about it and for them to say what they were trying to do. A couple of them were mystified by the fact that I was there and that I thought that Western travelers would be interested in coming. But that was really a tiny, tiny minority. The rest of the time, it was a great way to exchange and give them the opportunity to say things about what they do, because some of them don't have the staff, don't have the time to have information in English. They don't have an English website. You don't have labels in English. So it was a way also to help people find them, tell them information about it and say, look, you may not have a lot of information in English, but now you know what's happening. Go and have a look because it's worth it, even if you can't read much about it.
That was Sophie Richard, whose new book, The Art Lover's Guide to Japanese Museums, is out now and available in Monocle shops all over the world. For those just joining us, you're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. Somehow, over their decades of terrorising, provoking and just plain messing with the international art scene, the British brothers Jake and Dinos Chapman have never held a solo show in North America. That's being put right this week as Montreal's DHC Art opens the major retrospective Come and See, fresh from London's Serpentine. It's a title so welcoming, it must be a trap. We sent Monocle's Patrick Pittman along to check out their held dioramas and dismembered sculptures.
When the world ends, there'll be no more air. That's why it's important to pollute the air now, before it's too late. So begins the epic title of one of the first works you'll encounter in Jake and Dinos Chapman's Come and See. Come and See is a mad, sprawling exhibition covering a career of reimagined and defiled Goyas and Victorian portraits, a crucified Big Mac cast in bronze, McJesus Christ, it's called, and a gang of mannequin clansmen to accompany you around the gallery. As I wander around the DHC art galleries in Montreal with them, they make it clear to me that they don't consider this a retrospective. This is Dinos, and then his brother Jake.
It's just the latest incarnation of what we do. I mean, a retrospective would be appropriate once we've died.
Yeah, I mean, I think the problem with retrospectives is that they involve just a very sort of linear temporality. And I think the thing with our work is that we use old work and remake work. You know, there's no progressive linearity to the work, so in a sense, a retrospective wouldn't really apply to us.
Phoebe Greenberg is the founder and director of DHC Art, as well as the nearby Phi Centre. Across both amazing spaces, she seems to have made it her mission in the last few years to push the city's contemporary art scene to be a little more proud and a little less comfortable. I asked her how she ended up bringing the Chapmans to town for the first solo show in North America.
I saw their work probably a decade ago, and I was in Venice and thinking about what I wanted to do next here. With what's happened in our recent political landscape, I felt that the Chapman brothers, with their ironic view on the world, was a great show to bring here. I chased them down. I went to Hong Kong to see The Summer of All Evil, and then I met with them in Seoul, Korea, where they were doing part of the show that you'll see here. My first meeting with them, yes, they were naughty boys in terms of their persona and having fun, because they anchor their work in their sense of irony and parody and critical thought about what's going on in our world. But spending time with them during installation periods, etc., revealed also a strong, sensitive spirit in both of them and great intellects.
Cheryl Sim is DHC's curator. She's been the one who's had to wrangle Phoebe's original vision and the brothers' errant psyches into a functioning exhibition across the gallery's two buildings.
It's been an epic journey, an epic install, and I hope people will get that sense of being overwhelmed by scale that is both on that sort of monumental and micro simultaneously. I think that's part of the experience.
When I see a Jake and Dinos Chapman work on its own in a gallery, my first reaction is usually a particular mix of shock and curiosity and a little bit of suspicion. The question of, what are these lads playing at? And how are they playing me? There's a funny thing, though, when the works all come together in a show like this. Those initial reactions fade into the background, giving way to the relentlessness of the practice. I put to the brothers that relentless is probably a key word to use if you want to try to understand them.
We're just very interested in a kind of a very intense production of the work. You know, the ideas are very intense.
We're very interested in excess. You know, there's going too far rather than leaving things hanging precariously, sort of enticingly. We nail them down.
Yeah, overkill. Overkill's a good word. I think overkill comes from Vietnam, doesn't it? I think it's the idea that there's a ratio of bullets per dead person, which I think was something to do with the overkill principle. And I think that kind of applies to our work. I mean, you know, that there's no subtlety in the work. I mean, there are subtleties in the work, but in a sense, what we try to do is really annihilate any kind of humanistic reading of the work by...
Poetry. Yeah, find a poem and nail it down.
Does that not become harder at this kind of scale of work, though, when narratives start forcing themselves through at all?
I mean, the thing is that however much we say we pursue these ideas about relentlessness and sort of this immersive aspect, of course we're not entirely in control of the work. And, you know, just by doing these shows, you can actually see the glitch in the matrix, in a sense, you know, the way that it falls apart. You know, that's kind of what we're exposing ourselves to, is the idea that actually that the work is also about the entropy, and even just the degree to which we can actually physically continue this is actually very physiological, producing this work. And it involves subordination to tasks which no one should have to do, like putting 3,000 toy soldiers on a diorama. It's not the kind of work that you can really withdraw any kind of great sort of romantic satisfaction from. You know, it's kind of relentlessly boring and relentlessly inexpressive, and, you know, it's not heroic.
Of all the pieces on show in Come and See, Some of All Evil stands apart. A continuation of the earlier Hell work, destroyed in a fire, of course, Some of All Evil is an epic diorama of human decay, as it might be depicted with plastic toy soldiers. Thousands of plastic corpses piled impossibly high, cavemen pulling in at a McDonald's drive-thru in their Flintstones car, rivers of blood, Ronald, his burger empire aflame, fishing off the edge of a jetty. There aren't words, really, but I asked Cheryl to give it a go.
I mean, it's huge, it's heavy, it goes on and on. It's exhausting to look at. It was exhausting for them to make. Jake often talks about 120 Days of Sodom as being kind of the effect of reading that is like the effect of looking at Some of All Evil, where it's these vitrines that are teeming with mayhem and carnage, and there's just so much detail and so much to look at that you could spend hours, and you will physically be exhausted by the end of that.
How do you think Montreal audiences will respond to the Chapman Brothers' work on this scale?
I think that they'll be, what the F? Well, it was really difficult for us to say what the reaction would be, but we know that Montrealers are not ones to shy away from intense, controversial, difficult work.
I put to the brothers Phoebe's earlier assertion that maybe there was a good link between their work and this city's recent history of corruption, protest and decay. Nothing doing.
I mean, that sounds like it's too purposeful.
But also, it sounds a bit, you know, the work is, it's not mournful. We're not kind of mourning the loss of something, you know, because if you just, you know, the idea of corruption or decay implies that it's kind of eroded from something principled and good. I mean, we're just not interested in that. We're just, you know, the work is kind of just, you know, it's more hilarious. It's funnier than that. It doesn't start off with something that gets worse. It starts off with something that's worse. As someone was saying, you know, are you telling us that we're all doomed? And we've said, well, yeah, we are doomed, but not as an event in the future. We're doomed at every instance.
For Monocle, in Montreal, and maybe at the end of all things, I'm Patrick Pittman.
There's limits to that.
And if you want to check out the Chapman Brothers Come and See, it's on at DHC Art in Montreal until the end of August. You're tuned into Culture with me, Robert Bounds. We'll discuss which women are pioneering in international filmmaking after the break.
A new generation of stationary entrepreneurs are reviving the art of letter writing. Monocle Films travels to Prague, Vancouver, and London to visit three stationery shops who share a love of paper.
I was always fascinated by the fact, like, how many different forms the simple piece of paper can have. I like the space that opens up when you unfold a simple piece of paper or when you open the notebook, and no email can ever replace the feeling when you open your mailbox and you find the letter there.
A celluloid celebration of old school stationery shops, now playing in the film's menu on monocle.com.
You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. The Bird's Eye View Film Festival, now in its 10th year, seeks to champion the very best in international female filmmaking talent. The six-day event, which kicks off this week in London, is a showcase of feature films, documentaries and shorts, all directed by women, alongside workshops aimed to develop the skills and contacts needed to make and distribute films. So who are the leading ladies whose work has been selected for this year's festival? And after a decade, is it still helpful or necessary to have an event dedicated so specifically to women in film? Culture producer Katie Bilboa invited the festival's creative director, Kate Gerover, into the studio to find out more.
Sometimes there's a misconception that because you're focusing on a gender, that somehow the festival is worthy, or that there are going to be a lot of films in the festival that are all about women's issues. What we do is we curate the festival very carefully, and that every film that has been selected is there because it's sort of cinematically adventurous and audacious. So that's what the programme is, because what we want to show is a breadth of work. Women don't just make one kind of film. This should come as no surprise to anybody, particularly women, I would have thought, but they don't. And so it's really important, I think, that we show that the films in the festival, you know, range from anything from comedy to drama to established talent to emerging talent, animation. We have everything in there.
Can you tell when you're watching a film that's been directed by a woman? Or do you think there is a voice or a difference that stands out in that sense?
I mean, I think it's interesting for me personally. It's like saying, can you tell when someone's, you know, directed a Marvel film or a DC film? Because often those feel quite generic. I don't think you can tell that films have been directed by a woman. What I have found in some of the films that we've programmed this year is that some of the films have really original voices, and they're not voices that we're used to hearing in cinema because there are so few films directed by women that are on general release. So to me, I find that fresh and original.
Looking at the feature films, there was one that you picked out as one of your highlights for this year, Night Moves. Yeah. Tell me a bit about this film.
Night Moves is a eco-terrorist thriller. They're not always easy words to sit well together, but it's a contemporary thriller for our times. And it's one of our more starrier films because it has Jesse Eisenberg in it and Dakota Fanning, who, you know, are two young people who are really disillusioned about, you know, the way that the government's treat, you know, climate change, and so they set out to do something about it, and they do something that's bold but that has kind of repercussions. The film is great, but what I especially love about this film is the filmmaker, and that's Kelly Reichardt. I'd worked on with her previous films, Meat's Cut Off and Wendy and Lucy with Michelle Williams, and I think she's just such a masterful filmmaker. She's so original, and she has such an incredible eye in the way that she develops her characters and her story. And she does it with really kind of minimal fuss, but with maximum impact.
What does that mean?
It's a doe. She's pregnant. The baby's alive in there.
Oh my God.
Is it difficult for female directors to get high-profile talent on board, do you think?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think, you know, look at Catherine Bigelow. I'm sure, I mean, she's a, you know, sort of great example of a woman who makes films that she wants to do but does it within the studio system and has access to stars. So I don't think that it's difficult. I think talent respond to really, really great scripts. I think things are changing. It used to be some directors would tell you that the male lead needs to be cast first, and if you ever cast a female lead first, and I've heard this from more than one director, then the male wouldn't, you know, it was always the male that needed to be cast first.
Gosh.
But I do really, I hope that that's in the past.
Well, one leading lady is Elaine Stritch, who you picked out as another favourite of yours from the festival. This is a documentary about the performer. I don't know, how would you describe her? She's a kind of
Broadway legend, entertainer, performer, one of a kind.
Well, let's just hear a little clip of that.
Ladies and gentlemen, the one and only Elaine Stritch.
I've got a certain amount of fame. I've got money. Wish I could drive. Then I'd really be a menace.
She's just truthful. She's truthful in her acting. On a personal level, she's very, very truthful.
You look good. Your hair looks good for a change.
She is confident and brassy and stylish and gorgeous. She doesn't wear pants.
If we both met when we were 35, I have no doubt that we would have had a torrid love affair that which would have ended very badly.
She is the conduit to a golden age of theater.
I did Virginia Woolf on Broadway, and for the first time in my life, I had an orgasm.
I mean, what a character. Who directed that then, and how did that film come about?
The director's Chiemi Karasawa. You know, we came across the film because actually it played in a festival in the UK in London earlier, and we'd seen it. But the Bird's Eye View programme already knew of Chiemi's work, so that's how we found the film.
This is the 10th year of the Bird's Eye View Film Festival. How has the industry changed over that decade? And do you see a different landscape now for women working in film?
It's a slightly alarming response to that question because the last decade hasn't seen a great deal of change and the statistics, unfortunately, have stayed the same. However, I do think that internationally everybody is really kind of waking up to the power of women and their voices and what that means, not just in film, but of course in many, many sectors. But recently there have been numbers, statistics that have drawn on box office success. So they found that where women are in, you know, more rounded characters and, you know, and where they're sort of three-dimensional rather than one-dimensional, these films are performing particularly well. And I think as soon as we make the link to women can sell movies rather than thinking that they can't, which is the sort of myth that has existed, then I think that we will see a real change. So I'm very hopeful for the next decade.
That was Kate Gerover, creative director of the Bird's Eye Film Festival, which takes place in London this week. Birdseyeview.co.uk is the place to find out more. Still to come in part two, we'll enjoy some more global music and history from Los Desterrados, explore the undiscovered world of Neapolitan music with Sal da Vinci, and explore another side of Moomin creator Tove Jansson. Putting the world in world class, it's Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. So back first to Los Desterrados, who also brought the world to Midori House last week in their musical Melting Pot. They explained all to Paul Noble after their session, but first, here they are with Esta Noche. Night, 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 night.
And I'm joined in the studio by Mark, Drew and Daniel from Los Desterrados. Gentlemen, welcome to the studio.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Hi.
That was a very rousing session out there.
Glad you liked it.
I mean, we have a lot of musicians passing through and we do a lot of singer-songwriter stuff and folk and soul. We don't have much North African flamenco 17th century Jewish crossover.
What? Really?
You'll be surprised to hear. Most people's idea of Jewish music is something very mournful in A minor with maybe a clarinet going over the top, or klezmer, which is, you know, this high-speed wedding music. When the whole Asian revival happened 15 years ago, whenever Talvin Singh and Anoka came through, the advantage was that they had lots of cool instruments like sitars and tablas and just fantastic-sounding things. Mm. And you've taken a whole new route into Jewish music because most people think of, like I say, klezmer and Woody Allen.
Well, I guess part of this would be because for most people, there's only two available stereotypes of Judaism, one of which is New York Delhi nerd bloke, and the other is like oi oi oi, you know, black hats, beards, Eastern Europe. And that's only a very, very small part of the Jewish experience. There are Jews of every colour in every place in the world. There were Jews in China very early on in history, in Kaifeng, for quite a long time. Some of my family's from India, some of my family's from Iraq. But everywhere Jews lived and live, we're part of the culture. We synthesize, we live in it, but it all comes out distinctively Jewish in its own way.
And that leads us onto the sort of topic of world music, which is a very patronizing and, let's say, sort of Western I can see you cringing there when I say world music. Now, obviously, you know, we use this to describe everything that isn't music of Western kind of blues origin. How do you as a band market yourself and say, we're making music, it's not hip-hop, it's not indie rock, it's not folk? How do you sort of get the message of what Los Desterrados are out to people?
Well, I think that it's important to say what it is, and it's Jewish music and it's folk music. And from then on, we like to give that as a starting point for people, and then they can hear us and they can go, oh, but it's Moroccan, you know, or it's Turkish or it's Spanish, you know, and we can fit into a lot of different places. We've got CDs that have been sold in Turkey and in Greece, you know, because our music goes down well over there because it has those elements of it. But, you know, rather than saying it's world music, and it's, you know, it's kind of a redundant phrase, this term now, because, you know, everybody seems to have a harmonium or a sitar or an oud in their band because, you know, boundaries have kind of disintegrated between categorizing different musics. So it is what it is. It's folk music, it's Jewish music, it's Sephardic music.
But on the other hand, you have this other way of looking things which you get from people sometimes, which is very much that only people from a certain area are allowed to do this sort of thing. And in Sephardic versions, that would be, oh, unless you sing it exactly the way that you it was sung in 1917 in Salonika before the big earthquake and fire, then it's not the real thing. And frankly, that just doesn't make a great deal of sense. No one wants to listen to music in that way these days. And Sephardic music has changed over time, and musicians have always played through the lenses of their time. And why should this be any different?
And their own influences. So you're right.
Yeah.
When you mentioned the prog or whatever, or the funk or whatever it is, or the soul, that is there. I think we can't deny it. There's rock. There's jazz. It's there.
Yeah, we're Londoners. This is where we're from.
We're Londoners, exactly, and we're going to embrace that and enjoy it.
That was Los Desterrados speaking to Paul Noble. And if you want to find out more about the band, just go to losdesterrados.com. Tove Jansson is one of the most successful children writers of all time, but the Finn who created the Moomins was also a serious painter. To mark the centenary of her birth, a special show celebrating her life's work has just opened in the Finnish capital. We dispatched reporter Mark Bosworth to find out more.
Among the crowds at the National Gallery, Tove Jansson's most famous creations keep popping up. For many, the name Tove Jansson is synonymous with the Moomins, the little white hippopotamus-like trolls who live in Moomin Valley.
Here they are for one and all, the Moomins are about to call. Come on and sit down here with me, they're here for you on your TV, they are the Moomins.
The Moomin books have been translated into 44 languages. Jansson's fans include the writers Philip Pullman, Esther Freud and Ali Smith. The children's author, Frank Cottrell Boyce, discovered the Finn Family Moomin Troll book at his local library when he was 10 years old.
I was completely blown away and enchanted by it. First of all, I didn't know that it was set in a real place. I thought she'd made Finland up. I thought Finland was like Narnia. Just these incredible characters, the Moomins and the Hobgoblin and Thingamir and Barb and the Hemulen, just this kind of amazing range of characters who were so strange but also instantly recognisable because you'd met lots of them, big noisy Hemulens and neurotic skinny filly junks and vainglorious fathers and incredibly brilliant mothers.
Tove Jansson was born in 1914. Her father was a sculptor and her mother was an illustrator, drawing money and stamps for the Bank of Finland. Jansson's niece, Sophia, now the creative director of Moomin Characters, says the artistic household was a huge influence.
The home that Tove grew up in was definitely one where they quite proudly thought that being artists, they were definitely sort of very worthwhile or important. Very early on, it became evident that Tove was also extremely talented, at drawing. So her choice of career was perhaps quite obvious early on, and both parents encouraged it, which is very nice.
By the age of 15, Tove Jansson was doing illustrations for Garm, a satirical political paper that ridiculed dictators such as Hitler and Stalin. These illustrations form part of this centenary exhibition, which covers Jansson's career. There are surrealistic paintings from the 1930s, modernist art from the 50s, and more abstract works from the 60s and 70s. Tuula Karjalainen curated the exhibition.
What I wanted to show is Tove Jansson from so many angles as possible, because her life is like an artwork also. She was a very exceptional person, a person that made things in her life and lived her life with her own principles.
The war had a huge effect on Jansson's work and her family. In 1942, she painted The Family, which shows her two brothers playing chess. One brother wears a soldier's uniform, while the mother and father watch from opposite sides of the room.
She didn't paint this kind of struggles and rifles and whatever, but the war is very much in her pictures. The atmosphere in that picture is sad, and Tove herself is dressed like a widow. It is a wonderful painting.
The war and the need to escape its horrors led Jansson to create a new fictional family. In 1945, The Moomins and the Great Flood was published. It was soon followed by Comet in Moominland.
She was meeting with some friends and they were talking about some sort of coping with this to create some kind of new world, some kind of paradise. And of course, you can see the Moomin books as her way of trying to create something else.
Boel Westin is a professor of literature at Stockholm University and was friends with Janssen for nearly 20 years.
The thing is that they're not just a paradise, they're not just happy, because this anxiety and this grief and so on is embedded in the two first books, and that makes them so unusual, I think. So you really see the war reflected in those books, I think.
Just before the opening of the exhibition, I met Lisa Valkiapar, a paper conservator at the National Gallery, who was handling the works as they came in.
We have an original painting for a cardboard game, where the game players, they are having a little adventure in a Moomin Valley.
So this is an original Moomin board game?
Yes, it is. I don't know if it has been sold elsewhere than in Finland only, but I have played it. My parents had the game.
What's it like for you to be able to handle original pieces by Tove Jansson?
I really enjoy it. I love seeing these. And though it's the same job as I do all the time, only to see these pieces, it's so much fun. They are so, so beautiful, and it gives so much joy to see them, the original paintings and drawings. Tove Jansson has been so skillful, and she has had a lot of imagination.
It sounds like you were, or are, a Tove Jansson fan.
We all Finns are.
Tove Jansson died in 2001 at the age of 87, but her work continues to entertain new generations. Cultural events celebrating her life are planned for throughout the year across Europe, Japan and the United States, and a Moomin film is due to be released in the autumn. For Monocle in Helsinki, I'm Mark Bosworth.
There were the Moomins. There were the Moomins.
Thanks, Mark. And if you're interested in seeing some of Tove's paintings for yourself, and they are pretty incredible, the exhibition is on at the Finnish National Gallery until the 7th of September. You're tuned into Culture with me, Robert Bounds. We'll be getting a bit Neapolitan after the break.
The Globalist provides insight and analysis of the key news and business stories in Europe and the Middle East. Informed, engaging and authoritative, it's a 60-minute bulletin of news, features and opinion. Two presenters in London are joined by guests in our studio and all around the world, including Monocle's editors and friends in our Hong Kong and Tokyo bureau. The Globalist also features an extended daily newspaper review with a special guest here in Midori House. And of course, we round up the business headlines with an expert analyst in a key city. All that and more every weekday at 6 a.m. London time on The Globalist.
Welcome back to Culture on Monocle 24. Hardly anyone on earth is unfamiliar with the Neapolitan anthem, O Sole Mio, but thankfully there is a great deal more to the music of Naples than this rather overplayed ditty. Salvatore da Vinci, or Sal da Vinci to his buddies, is one of the city's most respected singers, and his popularity extends far beyond the Mezzogiorno. He's just been on tour in the US and France. He's also just released a duet with the Brazilian singer Ana Carolina. Monocle's Tom Burgess Watson paid him a visit in Naples and started off by asking him to sing one of his classics.
Tu sei una cosa grande per me, una cosa che mi fa innamorare. Na cosa casi tu guarda me, ma non mora così guardando a te. Vorrei sapere una cosa da te, perché quando ti guardo.
Ma la musica napoletana.
Neapolitan music is a cultural style that is recognized across the world. The songs I write for my albums draw on my own culture, namely where and how I grew up. Ever since I was a child, I've been immersed in this musical tradition. When I express myself and write music, I write what comes to me most naturally. Neapolitan music is in everybody's heart and touches everyone.
Maruzella,
Quindi credo che la musica.
I think that Neapolitan music was heavily influenced by the music of the classical composers and the acoustic instruments they used in their performances. I'm talking about string instruments, mandolins, instruments that you pluck, drums and so on. And then there were the ladies who sang as they did their laundry. That's also where many of our popular songs came from.
Do you think the music of Naples is evolving, or do you think it's a little bit in the past? Do you think it's modernizing itself and changing with the times, or do you feel like it's staying the same?
Io credo che
I think that our incredibly strong culture has had some major changes, thanks to certain individuals, and a more modern style has evolved.
Uno di questi negli anni 50.
One of these individuals was Renato Carosone, who, in the 1950s, changed and modified the tradition. He was light years ahead of his time, mixing jazz, blues, and the local Neapolitan style. And so a new kind of music was born in the 1950s. It wasn't until very many years later that the new individuals came onto the scene, such as Eduardo Bonato and Pino Danielli, who once again revived a musical tradition during the 80s.
Napoli mille colore. Napoli mille paure.
Attraverso il dialetto napoletano che è stato riconosciuto dall'UNESCO.
A tradition which, don't forget, has its own proper language. Neapolitan is a language recognized by UNESCO. It isn't a dialect. Naples has changed, and I think Pino Danielli was a great innovator, and the tradition was given a new lease of life. Then there have also been major changes in fashion and tastes, and right now rap has entered into the Italian music scene in a major way, and also into the Neapolitan music scene too.
Quelli campani e anche napoletani.
The first rapper to introduce rap into his song in Italy was in a Neapolitan song. It was when Renato Carosone released the song Pigliato in a Pastiglia, which goes like this.
Alle palline grigie ero fosfato bromo televisionato di DT bicarbonato borotal che semolina catapace me semolina una gustata fiorentina mortadelle due panine con un mezzo litro di vino un caffè con caffeina grammi 003.
Figlia della Bastiglia sientami.
You've just been on a tour around the world outside Italy. Tell us where you went and how people received your music.
Io sono stato ad Atlantic City.
I was in Atlantic City for the first time. I was born in the US. My dream was to come back and sing for the Italians who had moved overseas, but kept in touch with their cultural origins. I hadn't been back for nearly 40 years, and people would ask me, how come you've never been back? You were born there. But I made myself a promise that I would go back with my family and that I would do two things, visit and perform. And the moment came. I also had a dream a few years back to take my music to Paris, and I managed to do this. And it was great to win over lots of French fans who didn't know me, but who came along to the concert anyway for one reason or another. And leaving the venue and seeing their reaction was magical. I want my music to be for everyone, and I want to take it everywhere.
Beautiful stuff. That was Sal Da Vinci speaking to Tom Burgess Watson in Naples, and Sal's new album, If You Love, is out now. And that's just about all we have time for this week. Next time, we'll be talking MIP TV, Sydney Biennale, and the state of the Swedish art scene. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer was Katie Bilboa, and the fire-eating juggler, Holly Fisher, showed off her skills in our cultural big top once again. We've still got time for one final track from this week's Midori House session. So here are Los Desterrados with Ijemia. Thank you very much all for tuning in.
Notte accesa la ma, che la maestà è opportuna perché ti vai e va. Che la maestà è opportuna perché ti vai e va. Che me lleva, che me trai, siete fondo stelanti. Dije mio mi chiari, notte è accesa la mano, che la maestà infortuna, dire che ti vai e va, che la maestà infortuna, dire che ti vai e va. Bundes